When I was in New Zealand, it was an unusual situation, and it impacted the work that we did, and it impacts the work that we do here in America. So let me just go back and reminisce a little bit. In New Zealand, the denominations there, many of them, this is some nearly 50 years ago, practiced closed communion. And by that I mean that their Sunday morning services were not evangelistic in nature. In fact, they call their Sunday night services their evangelistic service. And so when you're in New Zealand, and this is years ago, I'm confident it is not that way now, nearly like it was back then. But there was a rarity of having visitors on Sunday morning. And sometimes, even in the Lord's church, we would call our Sunday morning service the breaking of bread service. And that has to do with the matter of closed communion. Not that we practice closed communion, but the fact that you would just never would have visitors on Sunday morning. So our Sunday night services were more evangelistic. And I remember when we converted one individual, and because he was converted because he came on Sunday night and not come much on Sunday morning service, and he came on Sunday morning services, when he came on Sunday morning services, he said, "I didn't know you guys believed in Christian living." I found that absolutely amazing. And so we modified sometimes what we did on Sunday night so that they would understand and believe that we did believe in Christian living. Sunday night services are different. I remember years ago somebody says, "Dan, you preach differently on Sunday night from the way we do on Sunday morning." And I think we do. Why? Because those of you who are here have a greater knowledge than across the board of our Sunday morning services. And we need to be aware of that when there are Sunday morning services, we have a lot of visitors. They may not know one end of the Bible from the other, and so we just make an assumption. And I remember a young lady who went to Fred Hardeman, and she had just become a Christian in her senior year and in high school, and went to Fred Hardeman, and she said, "I sat there in those Bible classes," and they'd say, "Well, that's like in the story about Elijah and Naaman." And that's all they would say. Well, she didn't know Elijah. She didn't know a Naaman. And she says, "You know what I did? I bought me," you remember the old Herbert's Bible story books that many families had? She bought her a Herbert's Bible story book written for children. And she spent her freshman year there reading Herbert's Bible story book so that whenever she'd be in a Bible class and they would say, "Well, you know, this is about when they crossed the Red Sea." Now she knew that part of the Bible, and you and I need to understand that. Tonight's lesson is different from a lot of Sunday night's lessons, and you will need your Bible. We're not going to have slides tonight, and let me tell you how this lesson evolved. I had been considering doing a lesson entitled "The Story of the Bible," and start in the book of Genesis and go all the way to the book of Malachi in part number one, and then do part number two later, the rest of the story of the Bible. And as I began to do that and had it in my mind how I would present that lesson in a way that it would be a way that you would be able to remember it, though you already know all of these things, I decided that may be too much for me to do. So I backed it down and I thought, well, why don't I just do part one, the story of the book of Genesis? And then I got to thinking, how on earth can you cover the story of the book of Genesis? And I'm not sure where this sermon ends. I know we want to try to get over to Abraham, but we may not, and so there may be part one, part two, part three over the next several months, as you know, as I have these Sunday night opportunities to preach, to emphasize some things that we may not have seen in the Bible. And this may be only part one, and there may never be part two, because I want to encourage you to become Bible students. Let me ask you this. If I ask you, how many years does the book of Genesis cover? You don't have to answer out loud, but if you had to come up with a number, how many years would you say the book of Genesis covers? Well, it talks about Adam, it talks about Noah, it talks about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. How many years is that? Well, I hope you will have some semblance of an idea to say that's 2,500 years. That's amazing. Here's one book of 50 chapters, and you read this one book of 50 chapters, and you learn not just 2,500 years of history, you learn 2,500 years of profound history that explains about the beginning. That's the name of the book, isn't it? And so there are many things that begin in the book of Genesis, and we can start making a list, and we probably, if it were more of a class situation, would come up some 20 or 25 different things that begin in the book of Genesis. That's not tonight's lesson. Let me ask you this. How many years are there from the time of the creation until the time of the flood? If it's 2,500 years in 50 chapters, how many years is it from Adam until the time of the flood? Would it be 1,000 years? You think it might be 1,000 years? You know, wait a minute now. Adam lived how long and then he died? That's 930 years that Adam lived, so it's got to be at least 1,000. How many years of that 2,500 years are from the creation till the time of the flood? And the answer is, and it's funny, you can add up the begats of how old he was when Adam begat Seth, and Seth begat Enos, and Enos begat Cainah. You can add all of those up, and you can know it was in the 600th year of Noah's life that the flood was coming, and you can come up with the exact number of years. 1,656 years from the time of the creation until the coming of the flood. Now, here's a better question. How many chapters are involved? How on earth would you be able to tell what happened during all of that period of time? How on earth would you be able to abbreviate all of those things that are in there? Do you know how many chapters it is from the time that Adam's name is first mentioned, or even the creation of Adam is mentioned without him being named in chapter 1, until you get to the time of the flood? Noah is first mentioned in the closing verses of chapter 5. 1,656 years in 5 chapters. Wow. What all happened during that period of time? And if we had all of the events and all of the things that happened, think of how many chapters there would be. Are you aware that when you read those first 5 chapters, you have dealt, you know, with 20% of the time men have been on this earth in 5 chapters. You know those chapters, but do you know them well? And so the design of what I wanted to do, particularly in this lesson as it continued to develop, was to try to look at things that we may not have seen. We've read those chapters. We know about Adam, that's chapter 1, the creation of the world. We know chapter 2, the Garden of Eden. We know chapter 3, and that is, sin coming into the world. We know chapter 4, and that's Cain and Abel. Wait a minute. We're to Cain and Abel, and we're in chapter 4, and now all of a sudden we've just got one chapter, the latter, or a little over a chapter, the latter part of chapter 4, and all of chapter 5 before you get to Noah. That's an amazing thing. How many years are covered in chapters 4 and 5? You stand back and look at that from the Bible, that'll make you look at those chapters and really make you want to get in there and to look at them. And that's what I want us to do tonight. Now let me introduce this by saying, we use the word patriarchal age to describe that period of time. I don't have any problem using the word patriarchal age. I just wish there was another word to describe that period of time. I know the word we use, and I understand why we use that word. But the word patriarch is only found twice in the Bible, and the first time it's applied to the sons of Jacob, to the 12 sons of Jacob, and the other time it is applied to King David. So when we talk about the patriarchal age and use that expression to describe that first period of time, and let me say again, I don't have any words any better than that. You know how the Bible describes it? In Romans chapter 5, Paul says, even those that had not sinned after the time from Adam until Moses. Maybe that's the way we ought to describe it. I'll continue to use the word patriarchal age, but it bothers me every time I do, because you think about, well, Adam was a patriarch, and Noah was a patriarch, and Abraham was a patriarch, and Isaac was a patriarch, and Jacob was a patriarch, and not one time of those words ever used to refer to those individuals that are the primary characters during that age. Let's look at it. Got your Bibles? Look in Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, we arrive at that period of time whenever sin has come into the world. And in that period of time where sin has come into the world, God begins to pronounce judgment. You know, because you are a Bible student, and I believe you are good Bible students, you know the punishment that was brought on Eve. You know the punishment that came as a result of that sin in Genesis chapter 3, and that is the pain of childbirth and all that was involved in the pain, in labor pains and things of that nature, was placed there by God as a reminder of the fact that there is consequences to sin. What about the serpent? Well, serpent, you're going to no longer be as you have been. From now on, you're going to crawl upon your belly and you'll be eating the dust of the ground. What about Adam? We have not read carefully enough the curse placed upon Adam. Look in Genesis chapter 3. Verse 17, then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Skip into verse 19. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. It is remarkable how the premillennial view is of this verse, is that God cursed the earth, and whenever Jesus comes back, He will remove the curse from the earth, and the Lord will be, well, there'll be no bugs, there'll be none of the bad stuff that's in the world, and you'll live in a great, great place of bliss, at least for 1,000 years, some for all eternity. It's so easy to read the Bible and not hear what you read. Look at verse 17. Read it silently to yourself, and there might be a one word or two in there that you need to underline. Adam, you have disobeyed me. Because you heeded the voice of your wife, and you have eaten from the tree of which I commanded, saying, you shall not eat of it. I am cursing the ground. Wait a minute. Did he curse the creation? I am going to curse the ground. And when you and when the ground is cursed, it will be cursed for your sake. And Adam, the way the cursing of the ground impacts you is, in toil you shall eat of the ground all the days of your life. I remember in a Bible class, a Tuesday morning Bible class, I asked the question, did Adam keep the Sabbath day? And Rick Tibbett, who at that time was more of a babe in Christ, he'd been in the Lord many years, but he said, Adam did not keep the Sabbath. And I said, where is that? I mean, Rick, why would you say Adam did not keep the Sabbath? And I never heard this. It's great to hear those individuals who have not necessarily grown up in the church and what they read and what they see, and what they can teach those of us who've read the Bible. Do you know the Bible does show that Adam did not keep the Sabbath? Why? Rick Tibbett says, because Adam, every day of your life, you're going to have these thorns that are out there, verse 18, thorns and thistles, it shall bring forth, and you shall eat the herbs of the ground. But Adam, every day of your life, you're going to struggle for food. That is what this says, isn't it? Forget the premillennial idea of this and step back. And if you'd been Adam, you would have gone out when you left the Garden of Eden, and now all of a sudden these thorns and briars that had been there now are being multiplied because God had already finished His creation, and it shall bring forth, and you shall eat the vegetables that are on this earth until the day that you die. Adam leaves the Garden of Eden. The earth is cursed. That's what it says. And the curse that was brought not on the earth, but the curse that was brought on the ground from which man was made, the dust of the ground. Until he returned to the dust of the ground, it was the ground that was cursed. Got that? What about Seth? What about Enos? What about Cana? You start looking at the descendants, the children and grandson and great-grandson of the great-great-great-grandson, and you get all the way down 9 generations. I believe that is 7 greats plus 1 grand plus son to get 9 generations. Great, 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 great grandson. Maybe I miscounted it. I want you to see what they do. They were under the ground that had been cursed. Wait a minute. We said Noah is mentioned over in chapter 5. Turn over to chapter 5, and in chapter 5, you have the genealogy, the book of the genealogy of Adam in the days that God created man. He made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female, and blessed them, and he called them, the King James says, Adam in the day they were created. And so he dies. And so you get in verse 4, you've got Seth. In verse 7, you've got Enos. In verse 9, you've got Kenah. In verse 12, you've got Mahalalel. And after Mahalalel, did I get Kenah? You've got Enoch. What do you know about Enoch? What do you know about Enoch? Are you aware we've gone 4 generations and we know nothing? How long they lived and how old they were when they had their children, and all of a sudden, this period of 1,656 years in just 8 or 10, 12 verses, all of a sudden, you've covered 1,000 years of that. And then all of a sudden, there's somebody that pops up here and his name is Enoch. What kind of work did Enoch do? Don't know. What do we know about Enoch? Well, the verse tells us that by faith he walked with God. You read in verse 23, all the days of Enoch were 365 years, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What an amazing why is this here? He didn't die. Do you think individuals back in that period of time wanted to know what happened when you died? That's the question we have. What happens when you die? Had there not been an Enoch, all the way from there till you get much, much deeper in the Bible, you would not learn there is an afterlife. Two little verses that you've overlooked. By the way, it is interesting to notice about Enoch and what the Bible tells about him. He's mentioned in the book of Jude, and that is that Enoch was a prophet. He prophesied. Sometimes we talk about God talked to the fathers, and there's no question that the book of Genesis shows that he talked to Adam and that he did talk to Noah. But there's a prophet that is there. And sometimes as we describe this situation, we overlook the fact that Abraham dealt with a priest. There were priests and prophets, at least a priest and a prophet during the patriarchal age. And that'll give you just a reason just to get in there and try to think that one through. And there are a whole lot of questions you can ask about that, and I'd say, I don't know. But the whole way we describe the patriarchal age, we take like Hebrews chapter 1 and 1 and says, God in times past spake unto the fathers. And then we say that's the patriarchal age. No, Hebrews 1 and 2 is talking about the Mosaic age when he spake unto the fathers by the prophets. You know Abraham is called a prophet? He's the first man of the Bible that's called a prophet. And we never think about there being prophets during the patriarchal age. You think about Noah. Was Noah's work not to be a mouthpiece for God? And is that also not the work of prophecy? And there's a whole lot about this age, this patriarchal age, that is different from what we just, in a shallow way, talk about the patriarchal. He spoke to the fathers. And growing up in the church, I figured that God talked to Adam, and then he talked to Seth, and then he talked to Enos, and then he talked to Keanah, and then he talked to Mahalalel, and then he talked to all of these other individuals. He came to every father. That may not be the case at all. Seth, what do you know about sin? You know who he could ask? Adam. Adam was there. Tell me about what disobedience to God. Tell me the consequences of disobedience to God. And that's why the scripture we read tonight talked about Abraham. God says, I know Abraham that he will teach his children. Adam could have told Seth. Could he have told Enos? Are you aware? Adam could have told Methuselah. It's better than that. Adam overlapped the life of Lamech, the father of Noah, by 66 years. Doesn't that sort of change your view about, you know, they lived each other 30 years, and then the next generation came along, and the next generation came along, and the next generation came along? I just stand in, and I'm amazed at that, about that, because I'm not sure everything that was involved. But Adam was in a position to teach them about marriage, was he not? The very lessons that we talk about and the very application that we made, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and God joins them together. Could Adam have told Seth about marriage? Could he have told all of those individuals all the way down through that entire early part of the Old Testament? And so we get here in the book of Genesis chapter 5. Look down, we mentioned the fact about Methuselah. Verse 27 says, all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. Lamech lived 182 years and had a son, and he called his name Noah. Now watch this, saying, this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toils of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. Wait a minute. We are 1,500 years nearly. Well, approaching that anyway, 1,400 years from the time of God cursing the ground. And guess what Lamech is? Lamech says, we have this toil. We have the work of our hands, and that is because the Lord cursed the ground. Do you know what the meaning of the word Noah is? Rest or peace. And it is interesting as you look at this and as you get down to this part of something's happening here. I'm not sure how emphatic you could be about the fact that the fathers pressed the blessing upon their children, but here is a divine record where Lamech says, this is the one who will give us comfort, who will release us. Give us relief. Many translations translate this word. He will give us relief from the toils that we have done. And he called his name Noah, saying, this is the one who will give us relief from the toils that we have done. The American Standard said, This same shall comfort us in our work and in our hands. The English Standard Version, one that we use more and more often, he called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. I'm tired of working. I have been born into a world that has been cursed by God. And I'm naming my son because he is the one who will bring us relief from that. Did he? You go back to the book of Genesis. And this time, go to chapter 8 of the book of Genesis. In chapter 8, Noah comes out of the ark. He says in verse 8:16, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your son's wife with you. Bring out with you every creeping thing of all flesh, your birds and the cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on this earth. It's interesting to look at the other translation, and I love that part of the translation, that particular translation that says they may swarm all over the earth. Coming out, new world, animals, go out and fill the earth, multiply on this earth. It's a different world, isn't it? They're going to be able to go out in relationship to all of this. So Noah makes that sacrifice. And in verse 21, read it carefully. Then the Lord said, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Did you hear that? Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I destroy again every living thing as I have done. What's happened? God cursed the earth and brought a flood. And he says, not going to happen again. And God who cursed the ground in the book of Genesis, when Adam was cursed, the Lord says, never again will it be cursed. You know what God said to Noah? Noah, go out of the ark. You've been earning, your fathers have been earning their food by the sweat of their face. Noah, you go out. I've not only given you the herbs, I now give you the right to eat the animals. And Noah, you and your sons go out and you multiply on this earth. Why? Because the cursed ground is no longer cursed. And the cursed earth is no longer cursed. But we have thistles and we do have briars, do we not? Absolutely. And guess what we have that Adam did not have? Roundup. And think of the contrast. Every day of your life, you'll barely be able to harvest enough to eat. With the fact that now we're talking in America about a 4-day work week with 3 days off. Isn't that amazing? And so the Lord, before Noah is born, Lamech says, here is the one who's going to remove the curse God placed on this ground. I have no idea, and I cannot emphatically say that is a prophetical statement, but it sure fits in that context of what the fathers pronouncing cursings like Abraham did or like Isaac did on his sons and Jacob did on his sons. Lamech on his son says, this man is the one who's going to relieve that. And so when the Lord said, I will never again curse the earth. I will never again do this thing. Listen to these to this statement about that. Let me get over to this. The English Standard Version says, and when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again bring a flood. There will never be a flood. There will never be a curse. If we take that second part and said, from that day forward, there will never be a flood, we of necessity need to take that first part of that verse and says, and there will never be a cursed earth. You look at some of the other translations that are here. The New American Standard is one where, here's Young's literal translation. And Jehovah smelled the sweet fragrance, and Jehovah said in his heart, I continue not to disesteem any more the ground because of man, though the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I continue not to smite any more any living thing. It's the same in the original language, curse again and destroy again, the exact same language is stated. And so if the language in reference to the flood says, I will never curse the earth again, says that curse does not, or pardon me, I will never bring the flood and destroy the earth again, if that means there'll never be another flood, then would it not follow that the curse that was placed on this ground was removed when Noah came out of the ark and he had the abundance to go out, not earning himself his bread by the sweat of his brow, but now because the earth is no longer cursed, and so they can go out and enjoy the very things that you and I enjoy. Different kind of sermon. Get inside the text and listen, don't believe a word I've said. You study it for yourself. But I believe the logic that's been presented shows that the thing that happened in the garden of the earth was not the cursing of the whole creation of God. For whatever was cursed in the Garden of Eden, called the curse of the ground, was removed in Adam when he came out of the ark. That's it for tonight. Let's sing the song of invitation. You know, there's another kind of thing you and I need to be concerned about. Not the destruction of the earth by water, next time by fire. And you and I need to understand that this earth and all that is in it will be burned up in the fire of judgment, and we'll stand before God and give an account for the way that we've lived. Let me encourage you to live righteously. If you're not a Christian, why would you not let this be the night in view of the fact that God would destroy the whole world because of sin? Why would you not deal with sin in your life? What's God's attitude toward it? Ask Noah. Ask Adam. Ask all of those who died with almost no knowledge at all of the afterlife that you have such an abundance of knowledge of. He brings immortality to light in the gospel, and you know about the resurrection. You know about the judgment. You know about the fact that you are eternal in your very beginning. Are you right with God? You're not if you haven't believed and been baptized. For Jesus said, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." There's a picture on Facebook that I saw recently where there's a picture on one side of the picture where my pastor says you don't have to be baptized. And the other side is the very quotation of this verse, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." Don't believe what men have said about it, but do what God said about it, and you as a believer become baptized tonight. That's what this song of invitation is, to encourage you to give your life to Jesus, or if you're a Christian who's wandered away, to come back. If you're subject to the invitation, won't you come to the front right now as together we stand and sing? Will you come?